Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Hello and welcome to this panel on innovation and evolution in payments and the role of central banks. My name is Bhavin Patel, Head of FinTech Research at Omfit, and I'm very pleased to introduce our panel of experts today. We are joined by Oded Shalomi, Director of Payments and Settlement Systems at the Bank of Israel, Peter Conti Brown, Assistant Professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, Charlotte Hogg, CEO of Europe at Visa, Thomas Lammer, Deputy Head of Secretariat of CPMI at the BIS, and Judith Obolza, Managing Executive of Public Policy at Vodacom. Welcome to you all. This panel comes in great timing from last week's OnFIF meeting with John Conliff, who spoke about the need for public money. So in today's session, we hope to cover the different roles the central bank plays in payments, including serving as a catalyst, overseer, regulator, and operator. Increasingly, central banks are expanding their role in digital retail payments. What may be these new drivers for this trend for banks? And also, how do central banks decide when to operate the retail payment system? How do they ensure competition and resilience in retail payments? And when are they also key, when they are also the key players? And maybe what are some of the best practices and lessons learned for central banks? Before we begin, just some quick housekeeping points for the audience. If you have any questions for our panelists, please use the discussion box on screen, and we will try to get through as many of these questions as possible during the session. But first, to kickstart this conversation, Thomas, I want to turn to you and ask you to outline what the main roles that central banks play in the payments system in this typical digital age. Maybe elaborate on the four roles that the BIS mentions of catalyst, overseer, regulator, and operator.
Thank you very much for this question. And let me quickly note that the views expressed are mine and not necessarily those of the BIS and the CPMI. To your questions, safety and efficiency of payment systems and ultimately the trust in the currency have been core objectives for central banks for a long time, and they are not new to the digital age. So central banks have a variety of roles. You mentioned them, and they have, of course, have an interest in fostering the safety and efficiency of the national payment systems, including in retail payments, services, and payment instruments. And to fulfill their goals, they typically have these roles that have been laid out. Let me start with the operator role. So in an operational role, many central banks directly offer and run payment infrastructures, and the central bank typically provides wholesale payment system to settle the fund transfers between the financial institutions in central bank money on a real-time cross-settlement basis, or RTGS basis, as we typically refer to it. So these RTGS systems typically provide settlement services also to retail payment systems within a country. And we have seen quite an uptake of these RTGS systems over the past three decades or so. In 1990, there were only 10 RTGS systems globally, and the latest count is close to 180 RTGS systems that are deployed on a global level. Most of them are operated by central banks. There are also some that are private sector operated. But in some countries, we also see that central banks play a more direct operational role also in retail payment systems, and increasingly also in fast and instant payment systems. And we see that fast payment systems in general have a similar trajectory compared to the uptake of RTGS systems. So in 2001, the first fast payment systems was launched in Korea. And since then, we have seen almost 60 or even more than 60 fast payment systems going into operations. So there's a big uptake of them, and also central banks in a number of important jurisdictions play a key operational role in many of these fast payment systems. The second role of central banks typically then refers to the role as a catalyst or facilitator in this regard. And in this role, central banks maintain a close relationship with the private sector, with stakeholders, both from the supply and the demand side, including commercial banks and increasingly also non-bank payment service providers, also to discuss the priorities to improve a national payment system. And if I refer to national payment system in this context, it's not one single system. It's the entire ecosystem, if I may, of wholesale payment systems, retail payment systems, the schemes that are supporting it, and the institutions that are providing them. One instrument central banks in this regard use a lot is the formation of a so-called payments council or payments board. And we see that this is typically then formed in a multi-stakeholder setting with the demand and the supply side. And this is something where we see that about half of the central banks that have been that have answered to the recent global payment system survey of the World Bank, they state that they have such a national payment council or payments board within their country. One increasingly important role when it comes to the catalyst function of a central bank is to ensure interoperability, also to foster competition. This refers to your point you mentioned in the introduction. And central banks also, those with an interest in a specific region also increasingly try to foster and stimulate regional integration. And we have seen a lot of examples in this regard. On different continents from Europe to Asia to Africa. Last but not least, this is one of the very important roles of the central banking payments too, is the role as an overseer and sometimes even as a regulator. In this regard, oversight is a central bank function whereby the objectives of safety and efficiency are promoted by monitoring existing and plan systems, assessing them against the standards that are in place and when necessary also to induce change. And since the early 2000s, since the start of the millennium, the oversight function within central banks has become more formal and more systematic. And nowadays, this function is typically well established. Kind of referring back to the Global Payment System Survey of the World Bank, 91% of the responding central banks indicated that they have an oversight function in place and that they perform on a regular and ongoing basis oversight. With regard to retail payment systems, not all central banks have explicit powers to oversee retail payment systems or even retail payment schemes or instruments. But many, nevertheless, even if they don't have a formal legal power to do so, still monitor the developments in that area. Through tools such as frequent dialogue with the market participants and also research in that field. So let me conclude by kind of stating that or kind of claiming that the roles that central banks are fulfilling in the context of payments, they are not new. They have been around for decades. Of course, the new payment methods and innovations in payments as they take shape, possibly there are new challenges and there are new things to look at, but also the core role of the central bank in payment systems more or less remains the same even in the digital age.
Thanks, Thomas, for that outline of the definitions. Charlotte, I just want to turn to you, being a former central banker now in the private sector. What does the private sector do so well and where does it actually need the support and guidance from the central banks here?
Thank you very much. Hopefully you can hear me well. I think this last year, which of course has we've seen real human tragedy, we've also seen in our space such an extraordinary amount of change. And actually digital payments have done some amazing things. The ecosystem's done some amazing things. I think firstly, we don't really think about the degree to which we've managed to live our lives in the digital world and buy all the things that we need because we've had a level of confidence. We've almost never discussed it. But if you imagine what the world would have been like 10 years ago, if we'd been hit by this kind of a crisis, how we would have shopped, how we would have continued to operate, it would have been very different. So I think there's been some real positives in terms of the resilience of the economies that have come out as a result of being digital. One is the confidence I talked about in that stability that's just been mentioned. Two, I think, is the innovation and inclusion, frankly, that we've seen that's come about as a result of digital payments. So whether it's new ways to create virtual food banks that we've seen in some countries or the support of particular industries or the enablement of people who've needed to shop but also needed to shield. You know, the innovation has been really extraordinary. I think we need to talk more about it. And I think as a result, too, the economy has become more resilient. So if you look at the impact on spending of successive restrictions and lockdowns, the impact has become less over time because businesses have gone from a plan C or a plan D being to be digital to now something that's a plan A and they're already in that space now where they've gone digital. So I think there's a backdrop we've lived through and we'll continue to see the change from that's been very powerful. So I think the question is, okay, now we're living in a, I think, probably irreversibly more digital world. What does that mean particularly for payments? And what does it mean for the role that private sector plays, and as you say, the role that central banks play? And particularly, what does that mean in the retail payment space, where central banks have particularly operated in this cash world where, you know, they've been the best provider of that material? And I think I think it's quite helpful to think about sort of the Maslow's hierarchy of payments. So at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, which is the space I think central bankers need to be particularly engaged, in fact, it's just been mentioned, is kind of water, air, fire, security. And for payments, it's security, it's resilience, it's everything that pertains to financial stability and a clarity and a transparency of standards in that space, I think, is going to be vital. Equally, from a private sector point of view, leaning in with the best technology, with global data to protect citizens from fraud, and with global data to really address the cybersecurity issues, you've got a very strong foundation. The combination of clear standards and the combination from the public sector and the private sector delivering on that and using everything they can with best practices from around the world. As you go up the pyramid, I think that the degree to which the private sector leans in and the degree to which the public sector leans out begins to diminish. This middle layer in Maslow is love and belonging, which I think translated into payments terms is openness and access. And again, I think if we want to benefit from the innovation and the competition that's emerged through this digital period, central banks leading in to set standards about governance and openness and the degree of competition is important to create clarity for many different payment forms to emerge. And then by the time you get to the top, which is self-esteem in Maslow, but it's in payments, probably all the different use cases that we've seen and used ourselves, that is where I think the private sector is the primary, because that's how we lean forward into the future and don't get locked into the past. So I think that the hierarchy helps you to think about where the public sector engages most powerfully and where the private sector, you know, really should be allowed to operate, but on these very strong foundations of openness and very strong foundations about expectations of resilience.
Thanks, Charlotte. Oded, I just want to follow up about the central bank's role here. I mean, Thomas already outlined very well the different types as defined by the BIS. Is it a bit more fluid than that, the definition? And then speaking on the way Charlotte described the hierarchy of Maslow's payments, I guess, at what stage do central bankers do actually need to step in and support and maybe even operate the system?
Well, I think, first of all, thank you for the invitation. Very glad to be here. These are very important topics. And I think certainly in the last couple of years, the roles have become more fluid and we need to be much more attentive to market developments. Cannot always stick exactly to traditional approaches to regulation. Sometimes some players need more help than others. And Charlotte did mention equal and open access. I think that's really key. And when we say that, it's important to think about the structure of a payment system, be that RTGS, an ACH clearinghouse, a check clearinghouse, a national or international switch for payment cards, faster payments switch. Any of those will have the operator of the payment system, and then we'll have the participants. And so a participant could be a bank or it could be a non-bank payment system provider, PSP. And I think what we're seeing is that we need to give as equal access as possible to PSPs, be they banks or non-banks. And the competition among those PSPs is what breeds new innovation and digitization and the types of mobile apps that provide the value-added offerings to consumers and small businesses that perhaps weren't quite as available in the past. At the same time, I would say that as a regulator, while traditionally we have looked at the stability and the efficiency of the payment systems, every one of those that I mentioned, it would behoove us to also think about the different payment systems as potential competitors with each other. Said differently, that might mean different payment methods as being competitors to each other, depending on the use case. So where it may be appropriate to provide the ease and convenience of payment cards, as well as everything that comes with it, chargeback protection, payment guarantees, and so forth, in some cases, it may make sense to focus more on account to account, be it faster payments or ACH. Why? Because in some markets, perhaps the cards market is not as developed, or perhaps there are particular pockets of the economy that have not been penetrated by one type of payment method or another. And so it's important to ensure the robustness and efficiency of every type of payment system and not just access to each of those payment systems by the PSPs. And a couple other points that I'd like to make about the role as a central banker. And I also made a move rather than going from the public sector to the private sector. I went from the private sector to the public sector. Charlotte's smiling because I used to be part of Visa. I would say that it's quite different from what I expected in the sense that the payment system regulator at times needs to act as an advocate for the payments stakeholders when facing other regulators. So there may be a different regulator, whether inside the central bank or outside the central bank, that oversees the banks or other PSPs or other parts of the ecosystem. And often their level of knowledge and understanding, be it standards, be it business methods, their level of understanding is not quite as deep and sophisticated as those of us managing payment systems. And with all their positive intent, sometimes they might be missing professional knowledge that could help inform better decision-making, which would provide better equal access to all participants in the systems and breed innovation and digitization. And so at times, we find ourselves as payment system regulators really just explaining and educating our colleagues who are also regulators about what our system needs to look like. And then just one last point about the category of catalyst, which you mentioned first as a BIS category of things that we do as regulators. I think that is becoming more and more important. One of the early items that we identified as an agenda target is working closely with the largest merchant in the country, and I think this is true in every country, and that largest merchant is the government. The government is also a regulator, but they also operate their own payment system in that they collect taxes. Those taxes might be parking fees, they might be tolls, they might be payment for children's activities if the government is subsidizing it. And if you take the entire list of channels through which government funding reaches consumers and businesses, the government has quite a significant potential impact on the entire ecosystem. So to the extent that we can work closely with government regulators operating their acceptance as a merchant, we could potentially impact the ability to increase penetration of digital payments, be they through payment cards, faster payments, ACH, or any of the other payment systems that are relevant to a particular market. Those are my headlines.
Thank you, Oded. Peter, conflicts do arise from time to time. What do you make of these conflicts when central banks participate as supervisors of payments to a greater or lesser extent, and when they participate as operators of these rails as well?
It's an important question, and what a pleasure to be with you and these great panelists to tackle this and related questions. Let me take a slightly broader view on this, drawing from a long history of public institutions' engagement with payment systems and payments alternatives, and where these tensions and these conflicts might arise. In the 19th century, before the model of a technocratic independent central banking institution was firmly entrenched throughout the world, there were genuine tensions between private sector and public sector priorities in what a payment system should be. We often think in the 19th century in laissez-faire terms, a gold standard sort of accomplishing the needs of trade and finance without much intervention. But that's something of a myth because, of course, the political pressures to expand payment participation were rather extraordinary, especially in the United States and in Western Europe. And at the same time, opportunities for profitability and innovation in payments in the 19th century and recognition that that profitability introduced new risks, introduced new kinds of private sector regulatory structures, most notably the clearinghouse. So what did that do? Well, that created a fundamental tension between kind of the pulsing needs of the private sector to expand payments participation and pushing towards profitability and greater opportunities to expand those businesses, and a public sector perception that the risks that such profitability would create would eventually land back again on the people. In the United States, this led to a series of crises in the Gilded Age preceding the creation of the Federal Reserve system. When the Fed was created in 1913, it was created as a kind of answer to this payments problem. Our traditional thinking about central banks even today is managing inflation and price stability through interventions in short-term debt markets was not the model of central banking in 1913. It was much more of a payments architecture. And baked into that payments architecture was this conflict that you identify. Because the Federal Reserve banks were chartered as quasi-private institutions that were to participate for the purposes of profitability in the payment system. This led to, in fact, two of the Federal Reserve banks competing for business in Havana, Cuba, until the government said, hey, knock that off, go back to Chicago and Atlanta and seek your profitability elsewhere. So how do you manage those conflicts? They're very, very old. There's nothing new here. So when you see today in 2021 or 2025 or whenever it might be that FedNow comes online or the other real-time or fast payment systems, you see this inherent tension. How can an institution both participate in the provision of services in retail or wholesale markets while also overseeing their competitors? We certainly would not grant any private sector institution that ability lightly. If we did, it would look a lot more like an infrastructural good that would be regulated as a monopoly. But what I would point out is that we have been able to manage those conflicts for over a century. And that conflict, that idea behind sensitivity toward the driving needs of commerce to innovate and seek profitability for shareholders and expand participation for business purposes, and a fear of risk management because the residual risk has such spillovers that would be owned by the public and through the public, the central banks. That fork in the road, that difference still exists today and will drive a lot of the thinking and interactions that we should expect to see. So to sum up, those conflicts are very old. We've managed them more or less well. The creation of ACH, for example, is a terrific example of this kind of innovation working in exactly the way that you described. But there are genuine risks on the horizon as we launch to fast payments with both central bank rail or even CBDC, frankly, where there's both central bank participation and central bank oversight. And it's not the case that we've managed those risks well in each instance. Over the long arc, that those risks have been managed well, those conflicts have been managed well. But there are real ways that those could go awry. Most obvious would be the temptation for central banks to subsidize and provide priority to their goods, products, or services at the expense of others, of rivals or alternatives that, in fact, might be able to provide those services better. So it's something certainly to watch. We've managed it well over the long arc, but I think we can expect real skirmishes in the short and medium term as we introduce new rails, new technologies to solve some of these old problems.
Thanks, Peter. Thomas, just to turn to you, from your perspective and what we've heard so far, can a central bank separate out its functions here? Can it provide the core standards and benchmarks that could sufficiently regulate payments operators while maintaining the risks without having to completely overhaul and operate the system itself?
Let me build on Oded's intervention and the point he made. So Digital payments are built upon a two-tier structure in a sense. We have the backend with the payment systems and the associated arrangements, and we have the front end. The front end is provided by commercial banks, and we also see, of course, increasingly these non-bank payment service providers. And the backend, the central bank typically supplies this ultimate safe medium to settle both wholesale and retail payments, while commercial banks and the payment service providers, they supply the retail payment instruments to the end customer. And I think there you already kind of see a clear separation or clear focus of the respective institutions. I mean, the private sector itself, I think, can provide the innovation and creativity to serve the customer. As history can illustrate, the private sector can thrive on a solid central bank foundation. So whether promoting interoperability or setting standards or also leveling, in some cases, the competitive playing field, I mean, there are strong arguments, I think, for the public sector to play a role in payments, also in retail payments. And in fact, today's central bank's role is, I would argue, as important as ever, if not more so. So I think here, is a clear interest of the public sector to be involved and to get involved. It's important that central banks obviously apply the same standards to their financial market infrastructures or payment systems they operate on their own as those that are applicable to the private sector operated payment systems. If we now look at the backend of the payment system. And our standards, for example, the principles for financial market infrastructures, the PFMI, they apply to financial market infrastructures, whether they are owned, operated by central banks or operated by the private sector. And there are only very few exceptions when it comes to monetary or liquidity policies, where you might have different approaches. So I think there are several ways in which central banks typically manage this relationship, or some would say in tension between oversight and operations. Many central banks see transparency as a core feature here to be transparent how and what they oversee, including their own systems. In addition, central banks also typically have an organizational separation between the oversight function and the operations function. So kind of citing again the Global Payment System Survey of the World Bank, where more than 9 out of 10 central banks have a specific unit or department that is responsible for the oversight function. And it's also the case that typically in 85% of the answers or of the responding central banks, they have organizational segregation between this operational task and the oversight function. So I think there are certain steps that can be taken, which are, again, not really new. They have been, for example, mentioned already back in 2005 when we issued the report on the oversight of payment systems. Back then it was the CPSS that issued that report. So again, nothing particularly new in this context. But of course, some of the questions come again and are quite asked again in view of the changing ecosystem as such.
Thank you, Thomas. Just turning to a successful example of a private sector operation of payments, that's M-Pesa. Judith, the payments gap and financial inclusion need was quite evident and still is in many parts of Africa. So is the private sector here at telecoms company better suited in some cases with infrastructure, reachability, access to large customer base to provide the core payment solution?
Thank you very much for this excellent question, and it's a pleasure to be with you today. Look, mobile money supported by extensive mobile reach has really shown to be a platform for economic opportunity. And specifically in sub-Saharan Africa, it has transformed the financial services landscape and has been a game changer for financial inclusion. It almost kind of seems like a long time ago, but it really isn't. The first mobile money service, M-Pesa, was established only in 2007 in Kenya by Vodacom subsidiary Safaricom. And just imagine that today there are over 300 million mobile money accounts globally, 50% of those in sub-Saharan Africa. This is because growth has been accelerating fast. In the past 5 years, the industry has, on average, added 40 million customers annually. At the same time, if we look at the traditional banking providers, Global FinTech's data suggests that the share of adults with an account at a traditional financial institutions have remained flat over time. So to answer your question, it is evident that mobile money services provided by communication providers have and had a profound impact on reducing the payments gaps and are indeed well praised to provide financial services to all. M-Pesa that you mentioned at the outfront, which now has nearly 50 million customers today and is the largest fintech platform in sub-Saharan Africa for both the unbanked and the banked, is a preferred way to just do about anything that you can imagine in the payment space due to its affordability, safety, and unmatched convenience. So sending and receiving money, which was basically where M-Pesa started off with, topping up airtime, making bill payments, receiving salaries, and now what becomes even more important in terms of financial resilience going forward is saving or getting access to short-term loans. What is really critical to understand, it's always easy to do that in hindsight, but in the early days, mobile money required a leap of faith and significant investments. First, and also to your question, simply being a mobile carrier with a telecoms customer base is not enough. In particular, building agent networks and platform capabilities have been absolutely critical for mobile financial service delivery. Secondly, just having a USSD access, which is still the predominant access on the continent, or an app now on your phone is not enough. In other words, while the availability and access to mobile infrastructure was key, investments in innovation and new infrastructure alongside flexible regulatory sandbox approaches paved the way for the growth that we have seen. And just to conclude, this will also be critical in closing the existing gaps that we still have and increasing financial resilience overall.
Thanks. What more can the central bank actually do here to help out mobile money provision here, as we mentioned already, as a catalyst, but to try and gain that trust and help you with that leap of faith, as you said, just helping reachability, universal acceptance? What more can the central bank do?
So in order to support digital financial services, and I will be very focused here, central banks should be looking at three things. First, enabling scale to drive down costs. Second, facilitating speed of innovation. And third, driving financial inclusion and ensuring resilience of the financial sector. I'll just briefly dive into all of those. So first, driving scale requires an enabling regime specifically for cloud infrastructures and cross-border data transfer to allow for more agile and cost-effective ways to provide services. Today, what we see in particular on the continent are fragmented and restrictive regulations that are burdening the sector. They force not just new and emerging players, but also banks to use legacy systems and uncompetitive cost structures that prevent the low cost provision of financial services. So central banks today can do their part by accepting and encouraging the use of new digital technologies, such as cloud computing, paving the way for models, which I'm sure many of you are well aware of, such as software as a service, infrastructure as a service, and platform as a service. Second, to support speed and innovation, central banks need to continue with the successfully established sandbox or test and learn approach. This means creating an environment where regulations do not appear as hurdles, but as tools to facilitate the operations of the digital ecosystem. And it also includes paving the way for services such as microloans, insurance, and tailored saving products where significant gaps persist today. Third, and to conclude on this, to drive financial inclusion, simplified and risk-based KYC remains key. Initiatives such as waivers on bank to e-wallet and e-wallet to bank transaction fees will further stimulate the move to a digital ecosystem. And finally, and was spoken about before by my colleagues, to ensure resilience, which is so critical to the function of central banks, we need to come together to devise effective tools combating cybercrime and attacks. This requires close collaboration through established public-private working groups to build a more resilient and future-proof digital financial system. So I hope with these kind of three pointers, I could give an outline of what central banks should be focusing on in terms of helping mobile money and payments in general to be digital end-to-end.
Thank you, Judith. Thank you for the three points as well. Peter, just turning to the infrastructure, payments sometimes is referred to as a double infrastructure. That is infrastructure that's built on pre-existing infrastructure. So that first infrastructural system in the US, it's the banking system. In Africa, telephony. In China, commerce. This kind of changes the shape of payments infrastructure quite a lot. Should this be a concern, especially for international standard setters?
I don't know if it should be a concern. It should be a reality that needs to be confronted pretty aggressively. When we think about the evolution of payments innovations and then also payments regulation and supervision, we often think toward a standardization model. And in the payments, this is common in all kinds of models. In payments, the word we often use is interoperability. We want to make sure that different kinds of rails that have evolved in different settings can talk to each other. It's a worthy goal, but it's a complex goal because we need to recognize that this double infrastructure aspect of payments is because the problems that different economies and societies are trying to solve can't just be migrated from one economy to another. And that's why, despite many, many efforts over many decades in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, to build a more robust banking system, it did not succeed. All of a sudden, facility with mobile payments in the 2000s started exploding, even surpassing the facility in mobile payments elsewhere in the world. Why? Well, telephony took off much more quickly than banking infrastructure, in part because of traditional infrastructural concerns, like the development of roads and bridges, for example, required for a banking system, not as required for mobile telephony. So this comes up in how we think about the different kinds of regulatory climates for each place. So in the United States, as you say, the payments infrastructure is largely built on top of a banking infrastructure, which is why even when we have various corporations that have either been spun off from consortia of banks like Visa, for example, or even those that are owned still by banks like Early Warning Systems and Zelle and the Clearinghouse, et cetera, it's going to look differently than, say, the Chinese model where a really robust digital payment system evolves out of commerce. Now, what I find so interesting, though, is that we're seeing instances where some of those systems might offer advantages or disadvantages over other systems. Ant Financial is a great example of this. It arises out of a commercial context of Alibaba. But the People's Bank of China is looking at this and saying, you know what, we're going to import from the United States the conception of a financial holding company. We want this payment system to look much more bank-like. Reasons for that are complex and varied and depend a little bit on one's orientation to analyzing the Chinese financial system. But at least one reason for this is that when you have a system that's developed entirely within a commercial context, we just don't have the tools of bank regulation and supervision, which are highly relevant to a payment system that has a lot of intermediation or a lot of float. So when we're thinking about standardization across these disparate communities. Part of it is interoperability. That's going to be more independent of what the local ecosystem is. But a big part of it is understand problems like risk and contagion and what happens when one ecosystem with its fundamentally different environment breaks down because of weaknesses peculiar to that environment. What happens when that contagion might start to spread? And that's going to become extremely relevant when we start thinking about central bank digital currency, when the People's Bank of China or the Bank of Kenya or the Federal Reserve are functioning in such different environments because of reasons of history and society, culture, and even economics.
Thanks, Peter. You mentioned central bank digital currency. Central banks obviously feel the need for a more direct involvement here in innovation than they might otherwise. Oded, I just want to turn to you very quickly. So congratulations on the recent announcement with the exploration of the digital shekel. Could I maybe ask a few questions, even at this early stage, how you might be thinking about involving the private sector? From what I understand, this would be a two-tier model. How do you partner with and leverage maybe the private sector here?
Sure. And then if you don't mind, I'd like to say a word about trust and financial resilience as well. The question of whether to launch a digital currency or not has become quite central to many of the discussions among central banks or inside central banks worldwide. I know the BIS has multiple publications kind of counting how many of us are actually working on this. Some of us are doing it publicly. Some of us are not doing it publicly. We have now published a paper, and anyone in the audience who would like to do so is welcome to download it. It's in both English and Hebrew, providing a lot of background information for our motivations, as well as requesting information. You know, are there things we should know and take into account? So I would say the first headline is that there are no central banks, and the Bank of Israel is included, that have concluded that a CBDC, central bank digital currency, or in our case, a digital shekel, is something that we will pursue in production. This is something one of the other central bankers that we spoke with about this said, this is something that would potentially be the most significant thing we do this century, but we may not do it. So if we don't do it, we want to at least be prepared, and we want to make a conscious decision that it's not something we need to pursue. The questions around it are significant. How would a digital currency impact monetary policy? How would it impact, or what kind of technology should we use? Is blockchain the only answer, or any type of distributed ledger? What would be the regulatory framework? And as you mentioned, what should be the correct architecture? And I understand you're asking about a retail digital central bank digital currency, but there's also another side to it, which is a wholesale setup. So when we think about the retail environment, there are two ways to approach it. You mentioned that we are thinking about a two-tier approach, but let's understand what that means. If it were a one-tier approach, it would mean that individuals, residents, would use digital shekels by engaging the central bank directly. What that would mean essentially is that they would each manage an account with the central bank. Now, central banks do not have experience dealing directly with the broad public. And what we also do with cash and other forms of payments is we work through a two-tier model where typically banks distribute cash to the public. And there's a whole ecosystem around that. And I think globally, as well as in Israel, what we're thinking about as well, that is really the right model for us. We wouldn't necessarily issue a digital shekel directly to consumers, but rather we would make it available through third parties, be they banks, be they this new concept called narrow banks, or be they third-party payment service providers. And there are lots of questions when you start thinking about it that arise that do not arise when you think about cash. For example, how do you protect privacy? Do you need to protect privacy? I heard there's another country that's looking at this topic and has launched a pilot and is having trouble getting people to use their digital currency in the pilot phase because they're concerned about being tracked. You know, some people, the reason they want to use cash is they don't want anyone to track them. Now, is that for reasons relating to the shadow economy, or is it because, you know, they have something to hide, or is that just because they want to protect their privacy? Well, it's probably a combination. And as a regulator, you need to think about, well, do I need to protect cash and how far do I need to go to give that comfort to the citizen where she believes that her privacy is protected? Or perhaps we only need to protect privacy at certain transaction levels. Maybe she doesn't care if I know that she bought a cup of coffee for a few shekels, but she cares more about larger purchases. Another interesting question is, what happens if the systems are down? What happens if it's a smartphone driven and the battery runs out? How do I use my money? But let's assume that's easy. You plug the phone in. What happens if the server's down? How do you make offline transactions? Visa and MasterCard have great solutions for that. Do we need to look at how that works and learn from it? Is it significant enough? Do we really think paper cash will go away in order, and if it does, then we have a real problem. But if it doesn't, then okay, digital currency doesn't work, then you can use the paper cash. So you ask me how we would engage the private sector. I think like everything else in the financial system, central banks are quite good at establishing policy, establishing rules that ensure financial stability, less so at engaging the public. And so we would want to work through the private sector. And we also think it's important to work with the private sector to understand technological implications. You know, it's a new space when you could speak with 100 companies who claim to know a thing or two about it. Most of them don't. And that's because it hasn't been done. Everybody's figuring it out. We're working it out as we go. And every market has its own needs. Every market needs to ask itself, as we are asking ourselves, why do you need this? In some countries, during the corona pandemic, governments wanted to give out financial support to their citizens and businesses and had difficulty distributing funds because there were significant unbanked populations. And that is a good reason for them to use to set up CBDC. That's less relevant in Israel. Is it an important or possible way to address pains in cross-border payments, reduce the number of days for payment, and reduce the cost of a cross-border payment? Potentially, but then what would that look like? Do we as a central bank need to cooperate with other central banks to make sure our systems for CBDC or other types of systems integrate better? So for all these things, we certainly need to rely on the knowledge and expertise of the private sector. And even if we do things as a central bank, there's a limit to what an internal technology team can do at any institution. And I think that's true for us too. And so we are looking certainly to cooperate with the private sector in terms of implementing technology. If you don't mind, just let me steal a minute about what I mentioned earlier, which is something that Judith mentioned, which is the need for financial resilience. I think that really lies at the heart of the success of any payment method, be it mobile payments with M-Pesa in Africa or with any other company, don't want to pick any specific one out, or be it cards or immediate payments, what we call faster payments in Israel, or anything else. So everyone in the ecosystem needs to trust the payment method as well as the stakeholders and participants in the payment system. And if we look at the industry, I think this troubles consumers less, but participants care about this. We want to make sure that the entity that is supposed to transfer funds actually has those funds and they're able to settle funds, to move money across the payment system. And the reason that's an issue, people don't tend to think about this too much unless we're from inside the industry, so I'll try to put it in simple words. If a particular payment service provider, be it a bank or a non-bank, has committed to businesses or people to move money from one account to another, and that money hasn't moved yet, and that movement of money only happens once a day in a batch through a settlement window. What happens during the other 23 hours where the money isn't moving? Well, we're waiting for the settlement window for the next batch, right? But if during that time, that financial institution or payment service provider becomes insolvent, we have a serious problem in the system because all of the other payment service providers are owed money and they're not going to get paid, and they need to transfer funds to their customers. And so we need to create a settlement guarantee, and we do that through a loss sharing arrangement. We ask all the participants in any payment system to participate in this loss sharing arrangement, and there are many ways to set that up. The issue with that is that the big players have an easier time. Let's say we want to create a fund where everybody puts money in and then that covers any losses in an event of insolvency. The big players have an easier time. The small players have a harder time. And we talked earlier about equal access. So as regulators, we need to be aware of the need for this type of arrangement. And we also need to ensure that the participants in the system think about creative setups that make it possible for small players to participate as well as big players. And then also related to that, you mentioned that as a regulator or as a central bank, we're also an operator of payment systems. And so where we operate the RTGS system, most of these systems still work in batches and with settlement windows, but there are thoughts and trends towards extending the settlement window. So instead of having it happen once a day or twice a day, perhaps it could be all day. Perhaps the window could be open all day, and then you reduce the exposure of credit risk. And then as an operator of the system, you can invite or make it possible for smaller players to participate without creating an unmanageable burden in the loss sharing arrangement. I hope that was clear. It's a little technical, but it actually lies at the heart of everything we do in payment systems.
No, thank you, Oded, for sharing insights on the digital shekel and the resiliency comment. Charlotte, I just want to turn to you and bring up the point about the risk around lack of interoperability and maybe concentration risks. So some markets may be prone to tipping where single firms attain critical mass of users. And this could definitely happen in payments, and it's happened in some countries. Is this where we might want to see central banks and regulators intervene to kind of bring that competition back in?
So I think the best thing about the digital world we're now living in is that actually there's much more competition in payments than there's ever been. You know, for all the reasons we've discussed, ACH, faster payments, card schemes, cash, now all can compete. And consumers can choose what they want from a payment in a way they never were before. And instead of, you know, a world where you're kind of determined what rails you're using based on where you are physically, now you can choose. When I'm buying a holiday, for example, I might want to use a card scheme because I get my money back, or I know what happens when it goes wrong. You know, when I'm doing a different kind of transaction, maybe buy me a cup of coffee, maybe I do something different. So I think the first thing is we live in a more competitive world, and that's a good thing, and we should lean into it. For central banks to intervene in retail payments beyond the level of setting standards, particularly around resilience, which I think is incredibly important, I think a number of things have to be true. One is you have to believe that it truly is a requirement for both financial stability and monetary stability. Two, you have to believe that there is no other way of doing it, that you can't create a competitive environment where it didn't exist. And I think also you have to believe that you can achieve the level of resilience that the private sector could when appropriately regulated and monitored. And in the digital world, it's hard, right? Because you need global data to protect against fraud. You need global abilities to do cybersecurity well. And then I think if you decide to intervene and you decide not to go down the route of standards and transparency, which I'm a real believer in, then you have to say, let's only operate at the level of the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy, and everything else you've got to create openness around to engender that competition. Because otherwise, you're probably going to constrain competition going forward. And when we talk about interoperability, I actually think you've got to look at it from the consumer's point of view. They need lots of different places to go to deliver on a transaction. And one common standard or one common network is not actually the way necessary to achieve it, not in this world where technology is so great. So just to give you an example, Visa Direct, which can push payments into cardholder accounts as well as cards, you know, last year did 3.5 billion transactions using 16 card networks, 65 ACH networks, 5 faster payment networks, and 5 payment gateways. You know, and that's a world where we don't have sometimes the interoperability people want to aspire for. So openness, standards, transparency, focus on the base, and don't create single points of failure unless you're really sure there's no other way. And even if you do, make sure that you create the openness on top of it.
Thank you, Charlotte. Thomas, Charlotte mentioned openness, transparency just now. When we look at cross-border payments and the global infrastructure that underpins payments and settlement, there is additional complexity both in the standard setting on a technical and regulatory level. Could you maybe elaborate on some of the work you're doing at the BIS here and what more needs to be done?
I think a lot of the developments we just discussed when it comes to increased user experience, digital innovation, a lot of this has happened on a domestic level. And I think on a cross-border level, we still see that payments are relatively slower. They're relatively more expensive. They're probably more difficult to access. And very often they are less transparent. So enhancing cross-border payments as such has become a central theme for the G20, the CPMI, the BIS, and many other standard setting bodies and international organizations to that extent. And the G20 adopted end 2020 a roadmap to enhance cross-border payments. And this is an overall objective we are now trying to implement in the context of a program, a big program when it comes to cross-border payments. And here the aim is really to make it faster, cheaper, more transparent, and more accessible, while, of course, and this relates back to the initial statements, maintaining the safety and also security across both wholesale and retail payment systems. So the roadmap itself lays out this comprehensive plan of actions and in a broad range of areas to remove ideally the frictions going forward. And it sets out so-called building blocks. So there's 19 building blocks across 5 focus areas. And we at the CPMI are leading or co-leading more than half of these building blocks in this program. And it's really about improving and tackling the individual problems and also particular parts of it. And we are cognizant of the fact that technological changes alone will not deliver the scale of improvement we seek when it comes to cross-border payments. We see that divergent regulation, legislation, supervision, and oversight frameworks across the jurisdictions or gaps, sometimes even these frameworks can reduce benefits that might be derived from technological innovation. We see that service providers that are active in different markets, and I think Judith referred to data protection and cloud services, for example, and that there are issues when it comes to different data sharing frameworks and data protection frameworks. So all these are elements that are tackled within these 19 building blocks. So it's important to really advance consistent and relevant international rules and standards, and also to ensure local transposition that can mitigate these challenges we are facing. And this is, of course, nothing that the public sector or international financial institutions or standard setting bodies can do on their own. So it's something that we have to do in cooperation together with the private sector. And a lot of the colleagues that are on this call are really actively contributing and involved in this work. So it's really something where we need to tackle it from both from the public sector side as well as the private sector side in order to make sure that cross-border payments in future become closer, at least to kind of close the gap a bit to the experience we face on domestic payments. So there are certain elements like, for example, looking at the existing payment infrastructures and how to improve it. Addressing access to payment systems, operating hours across different jurisdictions, increased usage of payment versus payment mechanisms when it comes to foreign exchange transactions. It's also kind of looking at the oversight, legal and regulatory framework. It's about creating a common vision, common targets that are supported both by the public and the private sector, which is a very important data standards, messaging standards are one of the key issues here. A lot is lost in translation, if I may say so, when it comes to cross-border payments. And last but not least, of course, we're also looking into the kind of more, let's say, forward-looking topics like central bank digital currencies or global stablecoin arrangements, kind of recognizing that these are more exploratory thoughts in this regard. And a lot of them are still need to rely on the and improvements in existing legal and regulatory framework and also infrastructures to thrive. So it's something we, many of us are engaged in. And so it's a really call to action to make sure that cross-border payments are kind of, trying to keep up with the developments we see on a domestic level.
Thank you, Thomas. Judith, I just want to turn to you, building on some of the comments that Thomas has already made. As a participant in these global networks, are there any practical examples you can share with regard to mobile money, how it can help achieve SDG goals here today? And also, are there still some of the frictions and pain points that we still need to overcome in cross-border payments, especially with mobile money?
Thank you very much. I think Thomas touched upon some very important points, and remittances are indeed key contributors to the 2030 Sustainable Development Agenda. And specifically, Sustainable Development Goal 10C that refers to the reduction of remittance prices to 3% of the sent amount by 2030. But there are obviously many more elements that Thomas touched on. Today, the cost of sending remittances is at a global average of about 7%. And if we look at Sub-Saharan Africa and the South African corridor specifically, it is currently at about 14% of the sent amount. So when we look at the goal, it's far away. There's a big gap. However, we've shown that if we control as mobile money providers, and there are other fintech players involved in this as well, the send and receive side, as is in the case, for instance, in the Tanzania-Kenya corridor today, we can reduce costs below the 3% of the send amount. So to your question, what is holding us back? What is holding us back at the moment are slow licensing processes where you require an international money transfer or cross-border license, long-winded approval processes. There are examples where we're waiting for up to a year to get a simple single corridor approved. And then restrictions, which we understand the reasons for, but I think there are creative ways to overcome them of prohibitions on the send side. So the good news, and maybe I'll leave you with that, is that we can and will be able to meet the SDG goal well before 2030. However, and this is a call to the central bankers on this call and panel, this requires urgent action by central banks and regulators to allow send, streamline and fast track approvals, and specifically allow mobile money providers to utilize hub-led models that drive efficiency and time to market.
Thanks, Judith. I just want to add in a quick audience question for you. It's asking about how long do you expect the cash-in, cash-out agent system to remain unnecessary in sub-Saharan Africa? Maybe it's a bit too specific, but it's one that's been upvoted.
No, it's not too specific. So I think it's a very good question. Obviously, we see smartphone penetration accelerating. And I think in some extent, it will go hand in hand with that evolution in terms of moving to is still very much a cash-in, cash-out based transaction system to a fully digitalized system. Now, this may well take another 10 to 15 years. And at the moment, and that I think is important, that we need to not forget the agent distribution systems that are established are still the bedrock of mobile financial services in sub-Saharan Africa, but also elsewhere. So I think it will be a gradual transition. But we all know that innovation happens faster than we think. And some of the barriers and kind of enabling regulation that I've been speaking about may well speed up that process.
Thank you. Charlotte, I have another question, which has been probably the most upvoted question. It's asking, can you really imagine CBDCs taking off? Surely the wider public could never grasp the concept of public versus private money. So just your quick thoughts on that. And Oded, if you have anything to add there as well, of course.
I think that the citizens of many countries are able to adopt many different forms of payments. We know that. We know we live in an age of great innovation. You know, our job is to create a payment system that all forms of fiat currency, whether they be digital or not, in fact, they always are in our case, can be used in an ubiquitous way to generate commerce both within borders and across borders.
Thanks. Oded, any thoughts on that as well?
I think it goes back to the market, and there are markets where there is a very low penetration of digital payments for one reason or another. And in those markets, there's probably a higher likelihood that the public will adopt a new form of digital money. I think to Charlotte's point, a lot of the usage of money is digital anyway, be it on cards or be it in some other way. So we need to think about, as I mentioned earlier, what is it that we're trying to achieve? But there are certainly markets and specific use cases in parts of the economy where I think the public will adopt it. I think it also relates to the point about interoperability that was discussed earlier. You know, we talk about interoperability among the same payment method, but, you know, do we need to think about interoperability among payment methods? You know, should I be able to use ACH to pay into someone's credit card? It's a question we never ask, but it's one worth thinking about, certainly when we're thinking about a new potential form of payment method globally, which is a digital currency issued by the central bank. It really is a question mark. It's not a statement.
Thanks, Oded. Just one final concluding question, maybe 30 seconds each from the panelists. When a central bank decides to operate in a retail payment setting, it would understandably become invested in the payments rail, and at least reputationally. So with the arrival of CBDC, likely in a few years, this is going to be a bit more concentrated. So how do these central banks maintain a competitive landscape and avoid picking themselves as winners? And are there any best practices that we can learn from? Charlotte, I'll probably turn to you first, and then I'll go to Thomas and so forth.
So I think set the standards for yourself that you would set for others around resilience. Take the best in terms of the data, the infrastructure, and the cybersecurity from around the world, and recognize that the digital world is a global one. Unfortunately, it's not a national one. Fraudsters don't stop at the boundaries, nor do cyber attackers. And be open. Ensure that you provide the minimum you can and the maximum in terms of enabling others to participate and provide other kinds of services on top of your rails that turn a simple money movement from A to B into a payment that really adds value for consumers and businesses.
Thank you, Thomas.
Of course, it's very much depends on the institutional, legal, and economic factors in the different jurisdictions. But one, I think, additional element that is interesting in this regard is, we touched upon it a bit, interoperability can be interoperability horizontally across systems, can be vertical interoperability. So from that point of view, these are, I think, interesting elements to look at when operating and offering payment services, or payment systems, I should say, from a public sector perspective.
Thank you. Judith?
Thank you. Just a couple of additional thoughts. So ensuring openness, I think, is key, as well as transparency. And then on the resilience part is really to build in competition into that. Don't create a single point of failure, and do involve public-private partnerships in setting up these systems and new environments.
Thank you. Peter.
Well, the United States in 1980, Congress passed a law that specifically forbid the Federal Reserve banks from favoring their own competitive services over alternatives by making them have to have a kind of profitability or at least cost recovery standard. That is extremely easy to manipulate. The language is not is pretty vague, but I think it's a good general standard. It's not that governments shouldn't be barred from subsidizing certain kinds of services in the financial system for certain kinds of participants. But to echo what has been said by my co-panelists, when they do so, they should do it transparently. And they should let it be said, we are subsidizing this service for these people for this purpose. And if they don't do that, and it ends up just kind of being just shoved into the tumble dry of the broader service, then we look at government participation and marketplaces and for beneficiaries that don't need the subsidy. And that can be truly lamentable because it can crowd out the kinds of services and subsidies that we'd want to see for parts of the population that genuinely need them. So I think having some sort of cost recovery mechanism in place and then where a subsidy has been decided upon by the national entity to make sure that that's transparently disclosed and designed.
Thanks. And Odette, finally.
So I think it really goes back to the one-tier versus two-tier system. If, as a central bank, we issue a currency, which we already do, right? All the central banks, that's how they started. They're issuing paper currency, and that is a retail payment method. But if we do that through third parties, be they banks, narrow banks, payment service providers, then we are immediately creating an ecosystem where competition takes place among participants. And I think that is where the innovation and specific unique use cases that will drive volumes come from. I honestly don't see that as a threat. I see that more as an opportunity, both for existing payment systems and participants, as well as for new market entrants.
Thank you. And on that final point, we can conclude today's panel. Thank you once again for joining us today. And thank you to the speakers for sharing their valuable insights on this panel. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.